From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Over 50,000 women have been raped in Bosnia and Herzegovina. The stories of these women are being documented by journalists and feminists in the former Yugoslavia. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Croatian journalist Slavinka Drakulic about rape as a form of genocide. Also today, human rights around the world. We talk with Kenneth Roth, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch, which has just issued its annual report. Roth says people assume the recent outbreaks of ethnic fighting are caused by age-old antagonisms, but they may have more to do with governmental abuses that exacerbate communal tensions. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Regeneration, about World War I. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Clinton's conference on the economy is wrapping up today in Little Rock after debates on whether to try to stimulate economic growth, and if so, how much. At one point, Clinton interrupted the session to complain that the much-discussed need for a stimulus package is a comparatively small issue compared with the problem of growing health care costs. Clinton indicated that he is leaning toward an economic stimulus that would cut taxes and increase government spending. Former San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros has formally notified Texas Governor Ann Richards that he's not interested in being appointed to fill Senator Lloyd Benson's seat. Cisneros is considered to be a leading candidate for Housing and Urban Development Secretary. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President-elect Bill Clinton tomorrow may name additional members of his cabinet. Clinton is considering Cisneros for the top HUD position, although Cisneros will not confirm it. Yesterday, the former mayor said he's not interested in succeeding Lloyd Benson, who was named last week as Treasury Secretary. Cisneros told Texas Governor Ann Richards on Sunday not to appoint him to the Senate seat. Richards had expressed concerns about choosing Cisneros because of his publicly acknowledged extramarital affair. Richards worried the seat would be lost to Republicans when a special election is held in May. Cisneros says his decision was based in part on family concerns. His 5-year-old son has a heart defect, which requires constant medical attention. He cited his son's problems in 1988 when he decided not to seek a fifth term as mayor. He considers a cabinet post more secure, according to Clinton transition aides. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
United Nations Secretary General Boutros-Ghali and Vice President Dan Quayle are in El Salvador today for peace celebrations. After 12 years of fighting, left-wing rebels have finished handing in their weapons and have become a legal political party in return for government reforms. From San Salvador, Tom Gibb reports.
Leaders from both sides attended a ceremony in San Salvador's international fair. They listened as the UN Secretary General, Dr. Boutros-Ghali, declared an end to 12 years of civil war, which has claimed more than 75,000 lives. All 8,000 rebel fighters have now given in their guns to UN observers. However, the peace process is not yet over. The government still has to carry out a controversial purge of more than 100 army officers accused of abuses. A new civilian police force has to be deployed and land given to ex-fighters from both sides. Vice President Dan Quayle also addressed the ceremony. He said today he's signing an agreement forgiving 75% of El Salvador's debt to the United States. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 8 points to close at 3,282. This is NPR. Pentagon officials said today they expect no major security problems as U.S. and French troops move into Baidoa in the center of Somalia's famine zone. Navy Rear Admiral Michael Kramer said it appears that most of the gunmen have already left Baidoa, where U.S. Marines and French Foreign Legionnaires are expected within hours. A convoy of 70 military vehicles is en route to Baidoa from Mogadishu now. Los Angeles Police Chief Willie Williams says officer training paid off in controlling last night's disturbance at Florence and Normandy streets in South Central L.A., the flashpoint in last April's riots. Greg Lamphere of KLON reports.
Chief Willie Williams touted the department's response to the violent eruptions following a peaceful demonstration for the four men held in the beating of trucker Reginald Denny. Williams rated the police response a 9 out of 10, saying the department is finally reading from the same page in the training manual.
The precision and the clarity of direction that was exhibited last night indicate that we've come a long way towards meeting our goal of working as one unit within the department.
Williams says at the height of the incident, the LAPD and the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department were at full tactical alert, sending more than 300 officers to the scene. Williams says 55 people were arrested, 11 of them teenagers. For National Public Radio, I'm Greg Lamphere in Los Angeles.
The federal agency that insures corporate pension plans said today that more of those plans are going underfunded. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation insures 85,000 pension plans for about 40 million workers, and it monitors the health of pension plans. The agency said that underfunding of pension plans grew to $51 billion last year. The corporation's director, James Lockhart, said that pension laws need to be changed to give employers more incentives to keep their pension promises. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the atrocities of war is the rape of women civilians. But some say that what is happening in Bosnia and Herzegovina is unprecedented in the history of war crimes. In October, the Ministry of Interior of Bosnia and Herzegovina estimated that 50,000 women and girls had been raped and many impregnated on purpose. The rapes are being documented by the ministry and by journalists and women's groups in the former Yugoslavia. My guest Slavinka Draculic wrote about this in last Sunday's New York Times. She's a Croatian journalist and a founding member of the first network of Eastern European women's groups. She's the author of How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed, and she's now completing a book about the war called Balkan Express. We called her earlier today at her home in Zagreb, about 100 miles away from the fighting in Bosnia. She calls the rapes a form of genocide. She says that these are not random acts. They are part of a systematic attack by the Serbs.
This is a part of ethnic cleansing. And it's not only that they are resettling Muslim population, that they have been killed on purpose, slaughtered, that is, and it's about 100,000 people who have been slaughtered and killed in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But this is also one of the things that is, I think, a special form of humiliation. And if it has been done in a special special places and with a special purpose of humiliating people, of on purpose impregnating women there, you know, and not only that, but put her in a specific situation. You have to know that most of this population comes from underdeveloped part of the country and a very patriarchal part of the country. No, these women don't need to be especially religious, you know. But the part of a Muslim culture is, of course, is a part of every patriarchal culture is that the rape is a shame, even if it happens in the war time, you know. So in order to make it impossible to live after the war, and this is the analysis of one gynecologist. In Sarajevo, his analysis is that in order to enable it to live together after the war, you know, once you kill a man or you kill a person, people try to forget it. And this had happened during the Second World War in Yugoslavia, too. People started to live together and they lived quite well together for 40 years. But if you rape a woman and she gives birth to a child, or if her surroundings, you know, her neighbors, her friends, her family knows that she has been raped. It is like a stamp of shame, of ultimate shame for that person. And it goes on generation for at least three generations, you know.
When you say that this rape has become a form of genocide, mm-hmm. is that because the Muslim women are becoming impregnated by people who aren't Muslim? Do they see this as a way of changing
the structure, yes, the demographic structure, because what they said, the witnessing is saying, for example, in this article that they quoted from Oslo Bojenje, what they are saying is that witnesses are saying that it has been explicitly said to them that they have been raped and impregnated on purpose to give birth to more Chetniks and to more little Serbs. There are mixing blood. The Muslim blood is no longer clean. need anymore. So this is, they are destroying the Muslim nation by infiltrating, in quote, Chetniks blood into the nation, i.e. impregnating women who are going to give birth to little Chetniks. And of course, they can't be taken as Muslims. I mean, there's not only that these children are going to be adopted, most likely, you know, but the idea is, one, that they are going to give birth to little Serbs, i.e. little Chetniks, and the idea is that for generations, people like Muslims and Serbs, because Muslim women have been raped by Serbian men, cannot live together in this part of the world, which is the idea of the ethnic cleansing.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with the term Chetnik.
The Chetniks were Royal Army during the Second World War, led by Draža Mihailović, and it is the term Chetnik that stands for something extremely brutal, and this is how the enemy soldiers are called, both in Croatia, enemy Serbian soldiers are called both in Croatia and in Serbia and Herzegovina, but it's also a name that they give to themselves, too, to revive the, you know, the idea of the Second World War. So it's both, I mean.
What evidence is there that Serbs are intentionally impregnating Muslim women?
One evidence is the numbers, because these numbers are unprecedented, and the evidence is witnessing. The evidence are witnessing from both sides, i.e. women are witnessing that this has been done and said to them, and there also have been people who have been, the Serbian soldiers who have been imprisoned, and their claim is too that they had instructions to do that.
What are the patterns that are starting to emerge? I mean, in reading the stories that you wrote up for the New York Times, it seems like these rapes are especially brutal, they're intended to hurt the women as much as possible and to humiliate them as much as possible.
Yeah, but before I tell you that, I just want to go, okay, I will answer to that, but I just wanted to read you something from the bulletin, the official bulletin, and it says that there have been about 2,000 women from age 7 to age 18 have been raped. Then 8,000 women from age 18 to 35. 3,000 women from age 35 to 50. And 1,000 over 50 years old women. And it says also that the youngest girl that has been raped had 7, and that the oldest woman had 80 years, you know. Now, going back to the special brutality, I think that when we are speaking about how much and in what way women have been raped and how brutally it has been done, we have to know that there is enormous brutal war going on in Bosnia and Herzegovina. The atrocities are just very difficult to understand. I've read another witnessing that doesn't have very much. I mean, it has to do with the rape itself. It is, the woman is a witness of a rape, but she includes something else in this witnessing. She is telling how her son has been killed, teenage son has been killed in front of her eyes. And what they did is they cut her son's head off. So woman, during the night, she wasn't able to bury her son, and she took his head, and she managed to get out of Bosnia, and she had with her her head son for 2 weeks with her, you know, sleeping with her, having it with her. So, I mean, these kind of things are happening, and this kind of witnessing, you know, we are reading here. So, I mean, you know, it gives you the idea about the war in general, you know. They are witnessing about little children being, you know, thrown in the fire, about 60 or 70 people being closed in the house, and then bomb is thrown, and they're, you know, they all get burned and so on. So I don't want to go into these details, but I want to say that the general picture of the war is that this is a very, very brutal war, and that it doesn't surprise me that women are being violated and raped and humiliated in a very, very special way. There are also many, many cases that are not recorded as rape, for example, and they are rape, in fact, of women being raped and then killed. So we have one very striking example of 300 girls from a house for retarded children in Visegrad, and they have all first been raped and then all of them killed. So, I mean, you know, this is just to give you an idea what is actually actually happening. And but of course, one of the problems with all that is that the women don't want to talk very much about that.
My guest is Slavinka Drakulic. She's a Croatian journalist, and she's speaking to us from her home in Croatia. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us on the phone from Croatia is journalist Slavinka Drakulic, and she's, by the way, in the process of completing a book about the war in the former Yugoslavia called Balkan Express. You know, in America, there's been so much education done about rape and rape as an act, you know, as a crime of power and violence. Is there any political context in the former Yugoslavia to interpret rape in? Do you know what I mean?
You mean any kind of public awareness about that?
Exactly.
Well, no, I have to say, unfortunately, no. This is a very patriarchal country. We didn't have feminist movement. We have only feminist groups, you know. And it was very difficult to break this kind of silence. It was a taboo, you know. We had a law, up to 10 years you could go, you could be punished for rape, but actually almost no one was ever punished for, you know, up to 10 years. That on average they would go out with 1 or 2 years for a rape, and also 1 out of 10 rapes would be reported. And this is a terrible thing, because nobody really reports. Very few women report rape, you know. And in a culture like ours, there is no public awareness, and this is one of the reasons that you know, women are not talking about it. Doctors are not prepared to deal with that in a special way. And plus, there is so many refugees, and they barely have anything to eat. So it's even very difficult to expect for doctors, for the institutions to take a special care of these women. So this is why we are, you know, trying to mobilize public opinion. And for example, the humanitarian organizations of Germany already decided to help by giving, or in this form or the other, of 2 million Deutschmarks. Austria is mobilized, Italy is mobilized, Switzerland is mobilized, France is starting to be alert about the whole situation. So there is a lot of talk about rape, women being raped, Muslim women being raped here in Europe, you know. And there is awareness of this, at least public opinion abroad, not in the country ourselves. I have to tell you one thing, that there is a very, very strange thing happened with Croatian women who have been also raped during the Croatian war, you know. There have been women, I mean, exactly the same thing happened to them, not on that scale, but we heard about the 150 women who have been raped and impregnated on purpose and who came back here, released from the concentration camps when it was too late for them to have an abortion, so that they had to, or they're about, or they already delivered the child or children. But the point is that in a way, Croatian government was kind of hiding it. They didn't point it out as a special kind of problem, as a special kind of humiliation of women, you know. And it, for me, is a very strange behavior, you know. I heard also one thing that actually I think it's maybe indicative for what is happening here. When a journalist asks a person, this very highly placed person who takes care of refugees, what is going to happen with these children, because there is no consistent policy towards this, he said, he started to scream, saying, these children are devil's seed. They are not going to be adopted by Croatian family. We have to get rid of these children. They have to be adopted by foreigners, and these kind of things, which I think it's totally, total lunacy. I mean, you can't deal with this like that, I mean, on such an irrational way. So maybe this is one of the reasons why the numbers and have been hidden in terms of what happened in Croatia, you know.
So you're looking at another problem, which is what happens when the children get born to women who were raped.
Yeah, well, nobody's dealing with that problem. This is what is chilling, because nobody is prepared to have any kind of system. And it seems that the best organization the organization who is going to deal with that in the best possible way is Caritas, which is a humanitarian organization of a Catholic Church. It seems that they are prepared to take these children, to give them for adoption and so on. They are the only, but there are no state institutions, there are no private initiatives, there is no policy, nothing has been disclosed about that, and I have the feeling that nobody really takes care about that. So I mean, because it is happening in Croatia, probably the Croatian government have to say something about that. But on the other hand, because those are Bosnian refugees, Bosnian government has other problems. They're not even thinking about what they are going to do with this. So I mean, it's a total. I have to say, this is a total confusion, and it's really chilling because most of these women don't want to hear about this. And not even. I mean, it's very difficult for them. Just now, I heard a report from a friend of mine who went to a refugee camp near Zagreb, and she said that she talked to a person who just today came. She's 42 years old, and she has been raped. And she said that this person is, you know, not only that she has a nervous breakdown, but this woman is real nuts. I mean, she went crazy. Her mind is gone, you know, and nobody is working with these kind of people. And not to tell you that most of the women are even, they cannot understand that they have been impregnated. And when you ask them, what are you going to have to do with these children? They are saying, we don't know. I don't want to see it. I don't know. You know, there are women who are saying, I'm not pregnant, and she's about to give birth. So it's an enormous problem. It's a real huge problem. How to deal with this? How to what is going to happen? I think that some kind of international help is needed. It's needed on several levels. International help is needed, in my view, to start a legal procedure to recognize rape as a war crime. Number one. Number two, some kind of a commission of joint forces of, I don't know, Red Cross, whoever, has to go and find out about these camps where women are kept and try to free these women. And the third one is, mobilization of funds and resources, know-how, and people who want to help to these women really in everyday living, you know. And the fourth one is the big problem of children. So we need some kind of international forum who is going to advise and to help and to say, yes, okay, these women, I mean, if they want to give kids to adoption, let's help them to give this kid for adoption. There are so many people who want to adopt kids, you know. So, I mean, you know, I think that without international mobilization of women's network and humanitarian organizations, and this is not going to work. I don't know what kind of disaster would help. I can even, you know, see that these women will kill these children once they are born.
The last time you and I spoke was in July, mm-hmm. and you said then that, there was food in the stores, there was no signs of fighting, but there were a lot of refugees that had come to Zagreb, and there was just a lot of kind of fear and anxiety in the city. How has the situation in day-to-day life changed since we last spoke in July?
Well, I think it didn't change very much, luckily enough. You know, people are just getting more and more poor. I think an average income is now $80. And it's the inflation is about 30% a month, and there is still everything in the shops. And Croatia, there is no war in Croatia. The parts of Croatia have been occupied. There is a little fighting going on, but there is no war here, you know. And there are no shortages, you know. So you would say life is good if it wouldn't be, you know, for lack of democracy that we have in this country, which is the problem. But it's also a problem of the future, not of this moment, you know. So this is one thing. But I think on the other level, not only that these refugees are being visible, but it's another thing that, people are preoccupied with that, you know, because the economy, the Croatian economy just cannot stand the fact, you know, because we have about 300,000 unemployed people, you know, and we have very many poor people. About 70% of the people living in Croatia are actually poor, you know. There is a very tiny, tiny little stratum of rich people, nouveau riche, who made money recently, you know. But the people are getting, you know, their standard of living is lower and lower and lower, and they're getting desperate about it, of course, you know. Now, there is a great talk about, if you're speaking about what is the atmosphere, is that the UN supposedly will withdraw in March, and then there is a great talk about rumors about the offensive that the Croatian forces will take to get back the occupied territories. But you know, this is all talk. I don't know. I only know that there is an instruction from the government to clean the cellars, you know, and to turn them into shelters again, which is a very, you know, very, 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 you know, something that you might fear, you know, that the war will come again, you know. And the front line is about 30 miles from Zagreb, so it gives you the idea, you know, that there is still this tension in the air, you know.
What would you like to see the United Nations or the United States or Europe do to help the former Yugoslavia?
Well, you know, whatever I would say would be just, I think, wishful thinking. I wasn't really clear about myself about would intervention in Bosnia help or not, because I don't like the United States to be a world policeman that is going to help, you know, and help in quotes in any region, problematic region of the world, you know. But obviously, the truth is that Europe hasn't been able to consolidate and to react in a proper way, to react in time to solve the problem in ex-Yugoslavia. Everything was well known and obvious even before the war started. Nobody helped and nobody did what needs to be done at that time, you know. So, I mean, it's really up to the United States now to maybe do something. And I'm quite puzzled would intervention help or not. But I think that maybe UN should have more, should do more in terms of, you know, fighting back, or in terms of being not only reduced to defend, but just also to somehow attack. And it seems that there is still total confusion in heads of EC, you know. The only thing that they know how to do is to close their borders, you know. So I think that, you know, UN could and should do more. I think that United States could and should do more. And everybody here has at least one wishful, you know, thought, and this is that Bill Clinton, when he comes into power, is going to do more, you know. I don't know, you know, if you ask me, I'm not a politician, but I think that something has to be done, because it's just too much to see what is happening there, and it's Europe.
What are the holidays going to be like for you?
I think they're going to be very sad, because nobody's here really celebrating the holidays any longer. I think we have already, you know, all these little trees decorated in Zagreb and so on. And we are living, to say the truth, we are living some kind of very schizophrenic life. We live a what I call a parallel reality. On one hand, you see all this terror and blood and refugees and killings, and you are aware of all that, and your life is poor and miserable and sad, and everybody is involved in that. Everybody has this feeling, you know. On the other hand, you still want to keep yourself somehow normal, and instead, in order to keep yourself normal, you invent this parallel, what I call parallel reality. You pretend normality. You pretend that there is going to be a real nice Christmas, and perhaps you'll invite people and you make cakes and everything. But eventually what is going to happen is that we are all going to discuss the one and the same subject that we are discussing for the last 2 years. You know, there is no escape from that. So in that terms, it's going to be, I think, very sad holiday, because you can hardly celebrate when you are seeing all that, and when you're aware that it is only 100 miles from you, that they are really, you know, slaughtering people, and to see all these documents, to read all these documents that I did, and to see it on television, and to know the people personally, it changes your life. We are just, you know. I know that there is this problem, you know, of the otherness. It's not happening to us now, but Bosnia is too close, so it's happening to us too.
Slavenka Dragulic spoke to us from her home in Zagreb. She's completing a book on the war called Balkan Express. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, human rights around the world. We talk with Kenneth Roth, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch, which has just issued its annual report. It offers some explanations for the outbreaks of ethnic fighting in the post-Cold War era and offers some suggestions to Bill Clinton about America's human rights policies. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Regeneration, about World War I and its effect on its generation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After 2 days of meetings in Little Rock and some 20 hours of discussion, President-elect Bill Clinton's economic conference has ended. NPR's John Edstee reports from Little Rock.
The battle over whether to stimulate the economy with higher government spending or reduce the budget deficit was at the heart of the day's talks. Most participants advised the new administration to stimulate the economy now and include a promise of future deficit reduction in a stimulus package. But there was also a strong statement rejecting stimulus and encouraging Clinton to pay for his long-term programs without increasing the deficit. The president-elect gave little clue about how he would proceed. He warned the group not to get fixated on a stimulus package and said he hadn't yet decided whether he would propose one. He stated strongly that he believed containing health care costs is the key to any successful program to reduce the deficit. Clinton also seemed very interested in proposals to ease banking regulations in order to get banks to lend more and spur the economy. I'm John Edstee in Little Rock.
Officials at IBM have announced another round of job cuts. The company plans to cut some 25,000 jobs next year and may, for the first time in its history, lay off workers. At the end of this month, the company will have some 300,000 employees. IBM Chairman John Akers says if there is not a sizable improvement in business conditions in the country, that some business units will have to have layoffs next year. The company says its financial performance continues to be weak. A federal grand jury in Washington has indicted chess champion Bobby Fischer for violating economic sanctions against Yugoslavia by taking part in a paid chess match there last month. NPR's Paz Cohen reports.
U.S. residents have been prohibited from commercial activity with Yugoslavia because of its role in the violent seizure of territory in Bosnia-Herzegovina and Croatia. The Treasury Department warned Fischer last August that he would be violating U.S. law if he traveled to Yugoslavia to play in a paid rematch against Russian Boris Spassky, who he had defeated in 1972. Fischer publicly spat on the warning letter and went ahead with the tournament, for which he was paid more than $3.3 million. If found guilty of today's one-count indictment, Fischer could face up to 10 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. A warrant has been issued for his arrest. But Fischer, who won the rematch, reportedly still is in Yugoslavia. I'm Paz Cohen in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 8 points to close at 3,284.36 on volume of more than 226 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. Officials say that Russia has defaulted again on government-backed bank loans and is now some $40 million behind on overdue bills. Officials at the Agriculture Department say that Moscow is now missing payments almost daily, after being late on repaying U.S. government-backed grain loans late last month. Over the weekend, Russia defaulted on $4.5 million. Two more women have taken their own lives with the help of Michigan pathologist Dr. Jack Kevorkian. Their deaths came on the same day that Michigan's governor announced that he would sign a law banning doctor-assisted suicide in the state. Don Gagne reports.
Today's deaths bring to 8 the number of women Dr. Kevorkian has helped take their own lives in the past 2.5 years. The new state law making doctor-assisted suicide a felony doesn't go into effect until next April. This morning, 70-year-old Marguerite Tate and 67-year-old Marcella Davis died after breathing carbon monoxide from a canister while Kevorkian stood by. Tate suffered from Lou Gehrig's disease, Lawrence had emphysema and heart disease. This afternoon, Kevorkian's attorney read from a letter left by Lawrence in which she criticized state lawmakers.
The Michigan legislature is making a big mistake. I certainly hope that they never have to watch a member of their family suffer in severe, excruciating pain.
Dr. Kevorkian, meanwhile, has said he won't obey a law he sees as immoral. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
In El Salvador, government and rebel leaders have announced that 12 years of warfare is over. At ceremonies today in San Salvador, UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said that the armed conflict in El Salvador has come to an end, but he called for tolerance on all sides. 75,000 people died in the dozen years of fighting. A ceasefire went into effect more than 10 months ago after a UN-mediated agreement was signed in Mexico City. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 1992 has been marked by outbreaks of ethnic fighting and civil wars around the world. The group Human Rights Watch has just issued its annual world report, reviewing conflicts in 53 countries, plus the former Yugoslavia and Soviet Union. These conflicts are often viewed as the result of age-old animosities. But the report concludes the conflicts have more to do with dictators and tyrants who inflame tensions for their own ulterior motives. The report recommends human rights policies as important tools in preserving world order. My guest is Kenneth Roth, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch and editor of the report. He says an important contribution to the explosion of ethnic fighting is the equation of the state with a particular ethnic group.
We've noticed that quite apart from more particular human rights abuses that often give rise to these communal conflicts, that there is a conceptual problem that underlies many of them, and that is a tendency to treat the state, which is to say the government, as the equivalent of the nation, which is to say a particular ethnic group. We often tend to think in terms of the nation state as a single term or a redundancy, when in fact they are two distinct concepts which often are not appropriately merged. And the ideal of having a single ethnicity within a single national boundaries is often unattainable in practice in a world where populations have ebbed and flowed over the years. Even in some cases where minorities seek to break away from a larger state, as, for example, has occurred in the former Yugoslavia, is in the process of proceeding in Czechoslovakia, or has taken place in the former Soviet Union, that effort to achieve the nation state by creating smaller, ethnically more pure geographical entities is often misguided in the same sense, in that the goal is often to achieve a greater degree of individual freedom, but ironically one finds greater insecurity because it's impossible to achieve this pure state, and one always finds a group that used to be a majority and is now suddenly a minority in a smaller state that rejects this effort and feels threatened by it. So the small Russian minority in Moldova or in the Baltics, or for that matter, the Serbian minority in Croatia or Bosnia, suddenly feels that what rights they used to enjoy in a larger pluralistic state might be jeopardized by this smaller entity centered around a particular ethnic group.
Let me ask you a related question. How did the end of the Cold War feed the kind of ethnic fighting that we're seeing in places that used to be under communist control?
Well, I think that there's a tendency to view the end of the Cold War as ironically a bad thing, in that it has unleashed these eternal antagonisms. But as I noted, I think that much of the ethnic violence is not so much the product of long-term hatreds as it is the product of particular past abuses. And one of the abusive legacies of communist rule is that it destroyed civil society, that is to say, the independent associations, the free press, the voluntary groupings in which free societies naturally organize themselves. And any country where there is not this independent, autonomous civil society, as in, say, a Somalia or in Iraq or Liberia, Sudan, as well as Eastern Europe, the former communist countries there, is in many ways more susceptible to the sorts of narrow nationalist appeals of a Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia, and is less able to assert the importance of individual rights and resist these appeals to people's basic instincts.
The Human Rights Watch has criticized the United Nations for abandoning Somalia in 1991 when famine and armed conflict could have been checked. What would you have liked to see the UN do?
Well, for a long time, there has been an effort or a stress on negotiation as opposed to actually stopping the ongoing violence and the abuses that were taking place at the hands of the warlords. And while the process of negotiating with the warlords served certain short-term goals in that there may be an agreement to allow a particular humanitarian relief delivery to go through, it had the tendency of giving the signal that so long as periodic relief supplies reached their intended recipients, that the UN was not concerned with the horrendous abuse being visited by these warlords on Somali society more generally. And during the bulk of 1991 and 1992, while the warlords were periodically willing to engage in these sorts of negotiations, they received no consistent message from the UN or really anybody else for that matter, that their systematic abuse, ranging from the shelling, the random shelling of Mogadishu, to attacks on relief supplies, must end. That message simply was not firmly delivered. In fact, the person who was most effective in making that clear, Mohamed Sanoun, the special envoy from the UN, a former Algerian diplomat, was fired in October when he, or forced to resign, I should say, when he was too public in criticizing past failures by the UN. And when an organization shows itself more concerned with its public relations than with the important mission that it had of getting aid to the starving and stopping the horrendous violations being committed by the warlords, the message that comes across is one of cynical and inconsistent promotion of human rights, a greater concern with institutional relations than with the important mission that the UN has before it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Roth, and he's the deputy director of Human Rights Watch, which is a human rights group. And they've just issued their annual World Report, and Ken Roth was the editor of the report. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ken Roth is my guest, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch, and we're discussing this human rights group's annual report, which has just been published. You're urging the Clinton administration to not equate democracy with the mere holding of elections. When has that been a problem in the past, where someone's voted into office, but they're really a dictator, but they're treated like they're heading up a democracy because of the elections?
Well, to cite a couple recent examples, I think Central America is probably the best example of places where there is an elected government in power, but that elected government does not exercise effective control over an army that continues to commit serious abuses. In the situation of, say, both El Salvador and Guatemala, the U.S. government has tended to continue to provide significant support despite this lack of genuine democracy, simply because there is an elected government in place. There has been a tendency in the later Bush years to move away from each of those governments, but that was a long time coming. And I think that what, particularly that early support of these abusive elected governments demonstrated, was a very narrow vision of democracy, one that was equated largely with periodic elections, but which neglected the other critical elements of democracy, that is to say, respect for minority rights, curbs on arbitrary violence, the establishment of the rule of law, and the promotion of a healthy and vigorous civil society. One, I think, particularly disturbing manifestation of the Bush administration's lack of a principled approach to democracy has been in its response to the problem of political Islam or Islamic fundamentalism. where, say, in Lebanon, the administration criticized the elections, three-part elections extended over about a month, only after it became apparent that Hezbollah and its allies had received the largest block of support in parliament. In Saudi Arabia, there's a refusal to press for democracy at all, largely out of the fear that a more radical power will or a radical force will come to power if the Saudi monarchy finds itself in jeopardy.
It seems that some countries are really in a kind of difficult bind now. Look at Germany, for instance, the rise of the neo-Nazi groups. Okay, so some of these neo-Nazi groups have been banned. You could make the argument that that is suppressing civil liberties. Yet to let these groups flourish is also to allow civil liberties to be repressed. In Algeria, elections were annulled after Islamic fundamentalists won seats in the parliament. But you could argue that some of these fundamentalists, if they came into power, would end democracy. What do you think the appropriate stand is to take against groups who threaten democracy?
Well, in 1992, there have been a number of situations. Germany and Algeria, the two that you cite, are good examples in which private groups or private bodies have threatened human rights principles or the rule of law. And we believe that the government first does have a duty to prevent human rights violations regardless of their source, but second, that it has a duty to do so in a manner that is itself respectful of human rights. So in the case of Germany, it's critical that while there's a need to stand up and provide significant protection against these neo-Nazi groups, to prosecute individual members of these groups who are responsible for violence, that the German government not transcend principles of free expression and free association by banning wholesale groups when in fact only particular members have been responsible for violent acts. Similarly, in the case of Algeria, the Algerian government claimed to be acting in the name of human rights when it canceled the elections that the Islamic Party had won, but it then proceeded to randomly detain thousands of Islamists, send them off to detention camps in the desert in southern Algeria, and subject many of them to quite serious torture. So in each of these cases, the principle that the means of defending human rights must include respect for human rights has been violated.
What does Human Rights Watch recommend in the former Yugoslavia now?
The first and foremost priority in Yugoslavia has got to be an end to the horrendous ethnic cleansing that has plagued the non-Serbian portions of the Bosnian population, as well as some non-Serbians in Croatia. We have not made specific recommendations as to how the international community should proceed, but have urged that something effective be done. And so far, the UN's response has been rather tepid. There is a no-fly zone that is not enforced. There is an embargo that is porous. There have been periodic condemnations of ethnic cleansing, but a systematic refusal even to identify the guilty party for fear of appearing to be partial and non-neutral in the course of the negotiations, or for fear of inviting attacks on relief organizations that are delivering supplies to those in need in Bosnia. I think what is needed is a much firmer approach, not only clear condemnation of those responsible, but also, for example, the establishment of an international tribunal to try the war criminals and a clear demonstration of the will to bring those people to justice, as well as perhaps more effective military action.
One of the big problems in Yugoslavia is that a lot of the women are being raped. They're being violently raped, and many of them are getting pregnant. There's a movement to make rape a war crime. What do you think of that?
Well, first, I think it's important to note that rape is already a war crime. And the movement to make it a war crime is really a movement to adopt some provision that more explicitly refers to rape. But there are already war crimes for torture and severe abuse of individuals. And it's absolutely clear that rape qualifies within that category of war crimes.
But it's not mentioned by name?
It's not mentioned by name, and that, I think, reflects a tendency worldwide to underreport or to neglect abuses against women. One sees this not only in the former Yugoslavia, but also in places like Peru, where rape is rampant but is rarely talked about. And we have made a very concerted effort to raise the profile of abuses against women so that they do receive equivalent attention to those against men. And certainly if making rape a formal war crime will help in that effort. We would support it, but I think it's important to make sure that that not suggests that rape is not already a war crime and can already be prosecuted.
Is there a part of the world that has really improved in the past year?
Well, I think one positive or very significant positive portion of the world is Latin America, where although there has been a serious reversal of democratic trends in Peru, serious threats against democracy in Venezuela, and a continuation of the very violent coup in Haiti, nonetheless, there does seem to be an entrenchment of democracy in a fuller respect than merely periodic elections. I think perhaps the best evidence of that is that there have been successful efforts in a number of Latin American countries to bring to justice those who have been responsible for serious abuses in the past, an endeavor that up until just recently had met with no success virtually any place in Latin America, with the partial exception of Argentina. But in this last year, we saw the establishment of two UN-sponsored commissions in El Salvador, which are in the process of ridding the 100 most abusive officers of the Salvadoran military and also establishing the truth about the horrendous abuses of the last decade, very significant steps to avoiding a recurrence of this problem in the future. There have also been successful prosecutions in Paraguay and an ongoing prosecution in Chile. Again, very significant efforts to make clear that one cannot commit abuses of human rights with impunity, that there will come a day when one has to be brought before the courts and will face one's due justice.
Very recently, Americans knew next to nothing about Somalia. Now half of the country has become expert on the subject from watching TV and reading the newspaper and from, you know, genuinely caring what's happening there. Are there other places you see on the map that will soon be, for unfortunate reasons, entering our consciousness like that?
Well, I'm sorry to say that there are a number of other countries that might well emerge as the next Somalia over the course of the next year. The ones that come foremost to mind are Afghanistan, where a serious civil war continues despite the fall of the Soviet-backed Najibullah government. Mozambique, where despite a formal peace accord, fighting continues and famine of a Somalia-like proportions threatens. Sudan, particularly southern Sudan, where the Arab Islamic government of Khartoum has been engaged in extremely abusive war against the black, largely animist or Christian population of the south, and possibly even Liberia, where a tenuous peace that had held over most of the last 2 years has now been broken, and substantial armed conflict once again is underway.
Ken Roth, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kenneth Roth is Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch. He edited the group's 1993 World Report. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the second day of President-elect Clinton's economic conference?
Hi, Terry. Mara Liasson has been paying attention to that meeting, that conference in Arkansas, talking about the American economy, and she'll report on the wrap-up. Also, a Republican view, distrustful of what's been going on, saying it all sounds like it will indeed cost more money. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Baidoa in Somalia on efforts to bring some form of security to that city. Also, I'll talk with Willa Shallott on the art of life casting, the art of making face molds of celebrities and politicians.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In 1917, the British poet Siegfried Sassoon was wounded in action in World War I and sent home. By then, Sassoon was disgusted with the war and did his best to get court-martialed so he could make his anti-war views public. Instead, he was judged temporarily insane. A new novel by Pat Barker entitled Regeneration imaginatively recreates Sassoon's relationship with his psychiatrist. Critic Maureen Corrigan says Regeneration is a stunning novel about the struggle between individual conscience and social responsibility during wartime.
The highest praise I can give to Regeneration is to say that it's as terrifying and bitter and mesmerizing as the great World War I poetry written by Siegfried Sassoon and his fellow poet hero, Wilfred Owen. When all the ballots are in at the end of this decade, I think World War I will win the historians' vote for being the most transformative event of the 20th century. But it's so difficult for us to recapture what it must have been like for an entire generation, a generation who'd been raised on images of chivalry, to suddenly find itself lost in a no-man's land of corpses, barbed wire, and existential doubt. Welcome to modernity. These days, with a nervous wave of our channel changers, we click from images of Somalia to Seinfeld. Our relative inoculation to horror is part of our distant legacy from World War I. Only a few things I've ever read have helped me experience that generation's sense of profound shock. Poems like Blighter's and Dulce et Decorum Est, autobiographies like Vera Brittain's Testament of Youth, and now Pat Barker's novel, Regeneration. When Siegfried Sassoon first meets the psychiatrist, Dr. William Rivers, and tells him that he's become a pacifist, Rivers says simply, "You realize, don't you, that it's my duty to try to change that. I can't pretend to be neutral." But Sassoon is stubborn, so Rivers tries to save him another way, by convincing him that he's become temporarily unbalanced by the war. Because if Sassoon is found by military authorities to be sane, he'll be sent to prison for refusing to fight. Rivers has other, sadder casualties on his hands besides Sassoon. There's the poet Wilfred Owen, who actually was sent to the same hospital as Sassoon for shell shock treatment. There's another patient named Burns, who's a human skeleton. He hasn't been able to keep much food down since that day in France when he landed head first on a German corpse whose gas-filled belly ruptured on impact. And then there's Anderson, a field doctor who's performed so many grisly amputations that he can no longer bear the sight of blood, which is getting in the way of his medical career. The power of regeneration lies in its vivid images of the hospital and battlefield, and in its evocation of what must have been common sights in Britain during World War I. Women whose skin had turned bright yellow because of their work in weapons factories, and men stranded on park benches, twitching, talking to themselves, maybe missing an arm or a leg. By the end of regeneration, Rivers realizes that in curing his patients of their psychosomatic muteness, blindness, and paralysis, he's actually robbing them of their unconscious means of protesting the war. As he did in real life, Sassoon, out of loyalty to his men, decides to return to France. And Owen, as he did in real life, also returns to the front, where he was machine gunned to death a few days before armistice was declared. He was 25 years old. Some great poets were created and then destroyed by World War I. And as Pat Barker makes us realize, a whole generation of men miss their chance of being ordinary.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Regeneration by Pat Barker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, round up the usual suspects. We talk with Algin Harmetz about the making of Casablanca. This year is the film's 50th anniversary. Also, we talk about the rise of neo-Nazism in Germany with writer Günter Grass. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.